Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. I'm your host, Maya Fisher-Friend, and this week we're talking budgets. And no, not our household budgets, but actually the country's budget. Because last week, the finance minister announced the medium-term budget, which is done every year in October. And let's be honest, most people only care about the February budget because that's when the minister announces changes to taxes. But actually, the medium-term budget is packed with really important information about how government is going to be collecting and spending our money over the next 3 years. It also gives us some idea of what we can expect in February and whether or not taxpayers will be on the hook. Now, to talk more about the medium-term budget, what it's telling us about the state of South Africa's finances and government's priorities, I'm joined by Nkubisa Magazi, who is Director in Public Finance at National Treasury. So welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Maya. Thank you for having me on, Maya, on The Money, and I look forward to this conversation with you.
Before we start, you're a Director in Public Finance. What does that mean? What is public finance?
So essentially, public finance is it's a division within the public national treasury. I'm sure you're quite familiar with the outline of the responsibilities and the key functions of the national treasury insofar as macroeconomic planning and policy setting, and also our assets and liabilities. And the public finance then is basically essentially the one of the anchoring divisions along so that are responsible really for setting out the fiscal framework of the country and also the expanding programs of the country. So what we essentially do, we are the division that also provides oversight to sector departments. We do the planning of budgets on behalf of departments and evaluate and appraise that and present recommendations to the various budgetary committees and also for consideration by the minister and ultimately by cabinet for approval endorsement. So essentially, we are sitting at the spine of the budget process insofar as the sectoral planning is concerned, and outlining and giving prioritization to those plans of government in the form of spending plans. Yeah.
Okay, so you really know where every single cent is going, and you also get to make recommendations about it. So are they definitely going to be asking a few questions around that? But I just wanted to start off with one of my bugbears, and that is how often the media refers to the medium-term budget as the mini budget, because actually it's not a mini budget, it's a maxi budget. This is the budget for the next 3 years. So let's just maybe start by explaining to listeners what exactly the medium-term budget is, and then I want to have a conversation about what this year's budget tells us about the state of the economy.
Sure. Thank you so much, Maya. So you are correct. The mini budget is really much more about a policy statement than it is about the budgetary side of things. It's about also just giving a sort of an early assimilation of what the policies are and the priorities of government for the next 3 years would be. And leading up, of course, to the actual tabling of the budget in February, we also use the MTPPS, of course, to outline any changes that may have happened during the course of the year. After the actual tabling of the budget in February, these would be anything that has to do with around our outlook in terms of the economy broadly, revenue outlook, as well as our expenditure focus. So essentially, those would be some of the key tenets or the key pillars of what would be entailed in that policy statement.
I want to actually ask you about that, because one of the key things we heard coming out now is, of course, October is 6 months left of the spending from February. And this is where it was updated that, wow, we're going to be a bit short on revenue collection, for example. And there's been some extra spending on SANRAL and on the DRC deployment that we weren't expecting. So very important, part of that update.
Yes, quite critical, because essentially what we do around the adjusted estimates is to take into account any of those spending pressures or spending priorities of government that were not known at the time of tabling the budget in February, and the sort of emergencies, because some of the issues that you've alluded to are in fact emergencies, wherein we would tap into specific provisions within the PFMA, such as Section 30 of the PFMA, as well as Section 16 in terms of emergency financing. So the emergencies, of course, that are contemplated, particularly in terms of Section 16, would be those that relate to economic events, major economic events, or in instances where there is a war or where we have such as the case where we had to deploy troops in assistance abroad and contributions to peace and stability as well within the continent.
I love the fact that government has an emergency fund. You know, it's called the contingency fund, but it's an emergency fund because I'm always telling my listeners, you must have an emergency fund. And even our government has an emergency fund because the government also cannot predict what the year is going to bring. So I absolutely love that observation as well. But how I think there was a lot of disappointment in the medium term budget in terms of the fact that revenue collection has been lower than expected. There was this additional expenditure of about 19 billion. And this means that, you know, things are even tighter than you were hoping in February. How do you would you describe the sort of the state of our economy at the moment?
Yeah. So thank you so much for that. Look, in the near term, growth is marginally weak, as already outlined in the speech yesterday. But there are reasons to be really optimistic of the MTF, you know. But I think in the most immediate future, especially when it comes to revenue, the economic growth outlook really it has been quite persistently low. And that has been one of the central policy challenges in terms of our economy broadly. And what we are projecting, of course, and as you would have seen from the speech, is that we're expecting that there would be a growth of 1.1% in 2024, and which basically then will be which reduces basically our revenue forecast that we had at the time of the main budget by 1% roundabout. However, there are prospects of improvements, considering, of course, the sort of reform agenda that government has put through the likes of Operation Vulindlela. And we are also, as an economy, starting to register some positive outcomes, especially when it comes to our energy supply. Those are obviously expected to have a compounding effect on the economy as we go into the MTF period. And some of the challenges that we've had in logistics, we're starting to see a lot of the effort that has been put in directed in that area starting to yield fruit. And these are the things that we are hoping, at least in the medium term, will elevate some of the risks that we're seeing on the economy side as well in there. Yeah.
Yes, and I think one of the big themes that I really picked up reading the medium-term budget was this idea that we are stuck without growth. We can't make money out of nothing, right? We need economic growth. And then I also had a chance to speak to the SARS commissioner, and he said that under-collection of taxes had a lot to do with economic growth. That originally, I think in February, salaries or the wage bill was expected to grow by 8.4%. It only grew by, I think, 5.3%. So, you know, if the economy is not growing, and I think this is what people need, you know, really need to understand, that the only way for government out of this, or the only way we can spend more and we can do more, is if our economy grows. So I think there was also a lot of emphasis in this budget on things to release economic growth, like more private partnerships, you know, accelerating infrastructure. And as you said, I mean, obviously, if we can get the electricity working, water working, but there's a lot of work ahead. And, you know, and I want to talk to you a little bit later about how you prioritize funds to make sure that the economy is growing. But before we get there, I wanted to talk about the debt bill because let me tell you, every listener here knows what it's like to have debt, right? So many South Africans are struggling to pay off their debt. But debt is a big problem for government. I mean, we're now spending 21% of our budget on debt repayments. Now, I know listeners are going to say, oh, that's 21, that's nothing. I'm paying 50% of my income onto to debt. But listen to this, is that households are paying off a portion of capital and interest. Government is only paying interest because they just roll over the capital. So it's like kind of keeping just paying the interest on your credit card. You never actually get out of debt. So this is my question. What is government's strategy to keep this debt under control so we're not spending, you know, 21% of all the money we collect just on interest payments?
Yeah, thank you so much, Maya, for that. And I think you are correct. It is a concern for government, and it's one of those fastest growing expenditure items in terms of our consolidated spending as government, which is something that we would want to arrest going into the MTF period. So, I mean, the one of our key focuses in going into this MTF is really narrowing that deficit by at least 5% of GDP in 2024-25. And by 3.2% in 2027, 28, and we're hoping that it's going to stabilize our debt by to at a level of 75.5%. Obviously, this is for many of those who are actually watching comparatively to some of our developing countries. One might argue that it needs to be significantly lower, brought to the levels of 40% or so. which is why we are targeting really a lot of our spending program as government as well towards those initiatives that are growth enhancing, particularly with the emphasis around infrastructure as a driver of that growth as part of really bringing us out of that sort of scenario. So what we're also hoping, and I mean, you've already highlighted the issue about the debt service cost itself, which is expected to peak at 21.5 of revenue in 2025-26, which is quite significant. So a lot of our attention, while it's multi-pronged insofar as we are servicing our debts because we can't afford that, but we are also looking into growth enhancing strategies and reforms wherein we are prioritizing, of course, infrastructure, but also linked to the institution, which is SARS. You would have heard also in the media briefing with the DG and others, there was this outline about why are we actually bringing more resources into institutions like SARS? Because we understand them as critical component in terms of really improving our revenue capacity generation as a country. And you do want to anchor around those institutions. We're similarly also putting a lot of money and resources to your institutions in your security cluster, because there is also the issues that we want to address in terms of corruption and money that is being malfeasances in terms of government spending, et cetera, and broadly in the economy. So all these things we see intertwined issues and reforms that we are bringing collectively to bring our debt to a sustainable level as government going forward.
And I know that there has been this commitment to a primary budget surplus. So just to explain to the listeners, primary budget means it's the spending that excludes interest payments. So the things that you spend on normally, not the interest, they're trying to keep that in surplus. So that little bit of surplus means that we're not going further into debt, and some of that can obviously be used to help service that debt. So it is a little bit like I always advise to when I deal with my readers is to say spend less than you earn. That always helps. But of course, in the middle of all of this, you've got a huge demand for more assistance. There are people, we have a very high unemployment rate, we've got very financially vulnerable people, and we're telling people, no, we're going to run a surplus to settle the debt. So I think this tension, how do you sit in public economics and deal with those two tensions?
It is quite a balancing act, I must say. Part of it is really being and trying to really stay on track in terms of the fiscal strategy, and also just educating the public as well as to what it is this fiscal strategy that we keep on speaking about, and especially to the point that you're making about the main budget primary surplus. Is that we are projecting that it will increase as part of that debt stabilization over the MTF, and with the hope that it will narrow then our deficit by 4.6% of GDP, as I've already outlined. So it's part of our broader anchoring of fiscal, or our attempts to anchor our fiscal policy over the next 3 years, and especially in with the considerations around the development of the fiscal anchors, et cetera. So it's quite a It's an intricate act, and obviously because we are also confronted with realities that you have already alluded to in terms of competing priorities in government. So what we do, or especially on the expenditure side, is to also try to see and identify inefficiencies in the system. For one, there is a review process that government is embarking, complementary to obviously the structural reforms that are being undertaken broadly in the economy, but there are those that are targeted towards improving efficiency of our spending. And we are going to be undertaking a comprehensive review of the budget process itself, while we are also looking into our public employment programs, which then responds to these issues about how do we then also look towards improving the livelihood and job creation capacity of the state, or interventions that are targeted to support such, and leveraging like the likes of our public employment programs, et cetera. So there is a review process underway, and that work has started in earnest, and we are hoping that by the time we are tabling the main budget in 2025, that would have matured in earnest to present concrete solutions or recommendations. So these are some of the issues that we are implementing as a means of really trying to strike this continuous balance about servicing our debts as a country, but also just ensuring that we are deriving value for money in terms of our existing programs. And of course, there was a process in terms of the macro reorganization of the state, which we had initially hoped would also assist in terms of really trying to minimize the amount of departments and portfolios that are there in the state. But we do know what has subsequently happened with the formation of the GNU, of course.
Yeah, the GNU is just added to the bill.
Yeah.
But I think it's also, you were talking a little bit about some of the overspending, and I know certainly one of the issues that was raised was the fraud around grants, and certainly the minister said there's going to be a huge review of the grant system and verifying information. I must just tell you, I know people who very openly have told me they earn 20, 30,000 rand a month who have applied for the child grant because they can, because no one's checking it. And I think if you're listening to this podcast and you're one of them, I think you need to pause for a moment and realize that, the child grant's only, what is it? It's a couple of hundred rand a month. If you take it, there's less to give someone who actually needs it. We could possibly increase the child grant significantly to people who really need it if people who don't need it didn't take it. And I think we also as citizens are responsible for a lot of the fraud and corruption, because when we go to Mpumalanga to buy a driver's license, and when we go and we take a social grant that's not meant for us, we are part of the problem. And I think that's a very, very key. I think we all love to say government must and government should, but maybe we should reflect a little bit on our own choices and decisions. But anyway, that's my moral lecture. But I you mentioned fiscal anchoring. And I know this is something that's everyone's talking about, but what actually is it? What does that mean?
So the fiscal anchoring really in a put in simple terms, really it's more like it's around designing a permanent measure of basically anchoring our fiscal policy and ensuring our debt is in a sustainable trajectory. So what it basically seeks to do in not so many words, it's to really ensure that there's a legislative process around our fiscal policy as a country, which of course you will note that it does have a certain nuances, which is why we've really undertaken quite a comprehensive exercise in really developing that fiscal anchor, which entails consultations with academia, with experts, just to also get what is the best practice out there. And also, where relevant, consulting with some of the political principles in designing that, because it has to be an all-encompassing sort of exercise in terms of that. But in an essence, it's a means by which government then tries to provide a more legally anchored approach in terms of our fiscal strategy and fiscal policy, and as a means of also just anchoring what our thinking around debt stabilization is as a
So
country.
this could include, for example, the maximum that debt levels that we'd be prepared to take on as a country relative to GDP. You know what? When you were talking about it, I kept thinking about our inflation targets. I imagine it would be similar to that, where we say that is the inflation target, and therefore we know the policies that we will follow in order to meet those targets. Is it something similar to that?
In not so many ways, yes, it would be, because what it seeks to do is really to outline and embed our debt sustainability strategy in terms of our planning and budgeting processes of government, essentially. So it will involve, I would imagine, some targeting, but I guess the true modalities of how we're going to approach it would be outlined at the time of the budget as well. So in a nutshell, it might be a legalized approach towards precisely those measures.
Well, I think in listeners, you're going to probably hear a lot about fiscal anchoring, and now you know what it is. That's important. Okay, it is definitely something that's we're going to see headlines about. But I want to come back to your role in, well, the role of the Public Finance Department around how you make decisions to allocate to each department. Now, I know we know about the social wage. That's all the things that government assists with: health, education, security, and that makes up about 60% of non-interest spending, or 6% of the primary budget, I should say. But even if you drill down there, how do you decide to put 1.5 trillion to learning and culture and only for 893 billion to health, for example? And then, so that's on the one side, but then how do you decide how much to put to infrastructure versus the social wage, for example? So how do you make those sort of policy decisions?
Thank you so much, Maya, for that question. So, as I'm sure you are familiar with some of the budget process itself, in that in truly it is an outcome of a consultative process, a process of consensus building, and really an evaluation of priorities across the different spectrum of the players that are involved in the budget process itself. So, and I think this is one of those common narratives where people think that National Treasury unilaterally decides on what actually eventually goes into the budget, when in fact the contrary is actually true, because we merely make recommendations about some of the things, but it truly is a process that is an outcome of policy considerations and trade-offs. So some of those trade-offs, unfortunately, will benefit certain sectors over others, but there is also a very morally aligned sort of thinking about issues in terms of what you prioritize as government, as you would see that we do have a certain biasness towards the wage, social wage. So that biasness is deliberate from government, but we're equally quite cognizant of the fact that we can't be putting all our eggs in one basket, if I were to put it in loose terms. So we do also invest in interventions that support economic growth, and as well as interventions that support infrastructure, et cetera. But I think broadly, as many would attest, as you can see in terms of the percentage, over 60% of our budget really is towards those frontline, sorry, your social wage, as well as your frontline services of government. And then gradually we do want to also just change that composition towards infrastructure as opposed to expenditure or the administrative functions of government itself. And there is also, and you did allude to it in the earlier point, this focus, a deliberate attempt to also control our wage bill, in that the state or the functioning of the state should not happen or at the expense of providing critical services to the citizens of the country. So I think it is a combination of factors, but I think there is also this morally attached agenda towards ensuring that the most vulnerable among us are deriving the most of those benefits, and that it is a distributive budget by its very nature, and addressing issues of equity, which is why we then also have your equitable share in terms of the arrangements there of either vertical or horizontal distribution of those centrally raised revenues across the different spheres of government. So in a nutshell, and I know I'm not doing justice to it, but in a nutshell, those are some of the issues and things that happen behind the scenes that ultimately then translate into this decision. And of course, we are informed by priorities that would be set in the medium-term strategic framework of government, which is now the medium-term developmental plan. And those are then translated into budgetary priorities, taking a lens of sectoral inputs, as well as, of course, certain issues that would have been announced through the SoNA, which is tabled by the president on an annual basis prior to the tabling of the budget, etc. Like we are doing at the moment, we'll make adjustments during the course of that year, depending on certain outcomes in terms of revenue, expenditure, and economic outlook broadly, and any economic events that have taken place, then we will be tabling how those adjustments affect it as well.
You mentioned one of the things is the wage bill, which is, of course, has always been, it has shot up quite a lot over the sort of last 10 years. And I know there was a whole section in the budget on the wage bill and the crowding out of the wage bill, I suppose, of other spending. And I think one of the strategies here is this early retirement for government employees, which will be announced in February. So no, I can't tell you any more details, but we had one of those in 2019, so it'll probably be similar. And that will obviously be one way to allow people to exit government employment, whilst not getting penalized for taking early retirement. So that's obviously one of the strategies to do. We just got to hope that it's not all the doctors that decide to take it. But I think
And the
there are
nurses
going to
and
be
the
limits
teachers.
as to who can take it.
Yes, of course. I think it's one of those strategies, really. Obviously, we do have a crisis in terms of unemployed young, capable South Africans. So, as a means of also trying to bring into that those younger talents into the mainframe, especially in terms of public service, it's one strategy. But I think what needs to be quite emphasized around that is the fact that it's a voluntary arrangement, so nobody's going to be pushed out. Those who want to participate, they will do that at their own volition. But of course, it will also require executive approvals insofar as safeguarding against the very things that you're talking about around the doctors, your nurses, and the teachers, because those are essential services, frontline services of government, which you don't want. So while we are on one hand wanting to put corrective measures or measures that are restoring our wage bill into a sustainable level, but you equally need to be mindful that you don't create gaps in the system elsewhere. So those are some of the critical things that it's two-pronged in that sense, in that you have one end, you want to curtail the wage bill, but you also want to address the issues in terms of unemployment, especially which affects young people. So you want to pay them, but at a cheaper level, But you also then, those who are taking those severance packages must do so voluntarily without actually feeling that they are being pushed out of the system as well.
I think, unfortunately, one of the challenges, and I see it, there's many corporates who have a retirement age of 60, a compulsory retirement age of 60, and many people get to that age and they cannot afford to retire and they're not allowed to stay on in employment. And I imagine that that's certainly one of the pieces of advice I'm going to be giving out to government employees around the early retirement is to say, can you afford to take it? And if you still want to take it, even if you can't afford to, do you have a plan B? Do you want to start your own business? Do you want to have some other line of income, maybe reemploy somewhere else? Because I think that is part of the challenge. Yes, we've got youth who are unemployed, but we also have people who do not have money for retirement. And we just know, I'm not even going to ask you about the two-pot retirement system because, oh my goodness, that has kept us all very, very busy. But that is just an example that people are pulling out of their retirement funds, let alone having enough to actually retire on. So I think that's going to be an interesting one for me, obviously, as I engage with many of my and many of my readers and followers are government employees, actually. And I know this because they've all been emailing me about the two-pot retirement system.
I'm sure you've been kept busy.
They've been keeping me busy. But I just wanted to really sum up, and I want to say thank you very much for answering these questions and giving some clarity as to how these decisions are made. And I also just want to make a point that these are very, very complex decisions. And I know the minister was sitting up there because, of course, one of his deputies is now from the DA. So he's now joined the GNU. And the minister was saying, his deputy was admitting to him that it's a lot more difficult when you're actually in government because you start to understand the multiple challenges. You've got on one side people saying you've got to be, got to get rid of debt. On other sides, there are people who need financial support. You've got all of these areas. So it's not easy. But I thought what was quite interesting to maybe end off with is just having a look at some of the next 3 years, the numbers that you are going to be managing. You're going to collect 6.2 trillion rand over the next 3 years. You're planning on spending 7.8 trillion. Now, of course, remember we spoke about the debt. That's a big difference. So are those figures, those are big figures. And basically the difference between the two will be debt, but it's going to be done on hopefully a manageable level.
Yes, indeed. So I projected, if I were to look at the consolidated expenditure, so on a year-on-year, so for one, we are targeting to increase expenditure to 2.4 trillion by the end of this particular financial year, and which is expected to raise to around 2.7 trillion by 2017-18. So which is basically expected to grow at an average rate of around 4.9% around about there. So it's really quite, when you look at the numbers, they're equally intimidating, but they are also, when you really try to start to introspect where are we actually spending the most, you'll actually see that most of that actually is actually going towards economic development, which is actually quite encouraging, which is the fastest growing item at around 7.8%, which is mostly driven by infrastructure spending, which is consistent with the outline that was provided by the minister yesterday. And of course, we offset that with some of the implementation of the early retirement that we've already spoken to. So, and the sustained focus, in spite of some of the issues that we're seeing, will still be on our social wage, etc. So, but I think what is quite critical and an emerging message around our focus over the MTF is the drive towards economic development, or instruments that are designed to really converge our spending or rejuvenate our spending in terms of infrastructure, etc. So that's quite encouraging, because it is a deliberate attempt by government really to bolster the economy, and infrastructure is one such way we're going to achieve that.
Excellent. And I think that's the bottom line. The bottom line is we can only meet everyone's needs when our economy grows, and we need infrastructure to make the economy grow. So that is the bottom line. We just need more money. So thank you very much for joining us today, and yeah, for giving your insights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maya. It was really quite a pleasure having this conversation with you, and all the best to your viewers as well.